Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'm talking with Kurt Heidinger. Kurt is a water activist based here in Connecticut, and he's writing a dissertation about Edward Abbey. Kurt, tell us a little bit about your history. Where did you come from? What do you do?
I'm a native nutmegger from the state of Connecticut. Moved to New York City for 10 years after high school. Played at CBGB's, among other things. That was a lot of fun.
What was your band?
It was called Uh-Oh. It was a three-piece, and we rocked the house. It was kind of a folk punk psychedelic thing that was wonderful. Then went deaf, was in the recording industry, and kind of lost hearing in the right ear, and then got into literature seriously, got myself here into the UConn PhD program for literature, and have been studying nature literature quite avidly for a bunch of years.
What's nature literature?
Well, it would be literature that just focuses on the issue of nature. You know, like you could say feminist literature or African-American literature. It's a genre. It's a very large subject, though. So just about any book could be a nature literature book. It's more of a perspective that you apply. It's something that you look for in texts to see how does this grand narrative of nature percolate through works of art. We can't escape it, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you're doing a dissertation here at UConn.
On Edward Abbey, who's a legend in American letters these days, a kind of grandson of Henry David Thoreau, who wrote a famous book called Desert Solitaire, which is a loving parody of Walden, and then wrote a text called The Monkey Wrench Gang that is rather notorious because it shows characters blowing up bulldozers and trains and trying to melt bridges down and such to keep the quote mega machine from invading the wilderness deserts of the American Southwest. Mm-hmm. And the big plot of that is the characters would like to blow up Glen Canyon Dam, one of the largest dams in the United States. And so I'm completing that, and in the meantime, I'm here also at UConn, just observing the way the water system is managed and planned for. I've found that a very fascinating extracurricular hobby.
There's obviously a reason that you're attracted to Abbey's writings, not only the fact that he was a monkey wrencher, but also he inspired, or he's a patron saint of the deep ecological movement and Earth First in particular. Was that the motivation?
Yes. Well, the motivation was I loved wild places to begin with and had always found that the quality hours of my life were not spent in front of a TV. They were spent usually on Class 1 drinking water, public watershed land. I found in his writing that he was discussing some of the same feelings I had, and then realized that he was worth studying because he claimed he was not an environmentalist, which I thought was funny. And I began to understand why he meant that, because an environmentalist is somebody who complains about the poison. Well, what I just did, complains about poisons in the water and such. And he never really dwelled on that. What he was really in this doom and gloom scenario. He took it for granted, but his books aren't about that. They're expressions of hope and rebellion, and they're cheerful and funny and deep too. He was working on the natural rights tradition that the founding fathers were, and that's what I started to notice, that he believed in natural law, and that fascinated me. What the heck is natural law? I've heard it all the time. If you read the Declaration of Independence, that's the premier statement. And if you read the UN Declaration of Rights, that's the best, some of the best lines are taken right from the Declaration. So I realized that he was making an equation between nature and freedom that was really deep. And then I started studying colonialism, the history of colonialism, and observed, as everybody does when they start to study that, that the colonists came in and...
North American colonialism?
Right now, let's leave it to that. And that what you get is the conquistador conquering nature and, mm-hmm. quote, natural people at the same time, you know, the natives. And it fascinated me that... natural law theory came about at that same time, and that it included these grand ideas like the commons, and John Locke was one of the premier exponents of natural law. So I started reading Locke and then comparing him to Abbey and started to think, wow, Abbey is really onto something here. And now I understand what he means. He isn't really an environmentalist. He's somebody who believes in a geography of freedom. And the equation is that the more urban an area is, the more less freedom there is, actually. That's his equation. I don't know if I agree with that totally, mm-hmm. but he really went for it. And that's how he was able to come up with the striking plots, you know, and to get drama out of this. Mm-hmm. But that anti-urbanism...
Let's stop there for a second. Do you think that holds true sociologically? If we look around the world, are people who are overwhelmingly rural more free than the urban people?
It's all contextual, you know? It is. You can't say... It's no wholesale generalization that you can rest easy making.
Well, North America and Europe and Australia are some of the most industrialized countries in the world. Are we more or less free than China or Africa or India?
Well, now we're getting into what is freedom then. And if you want to just define that, we can get back to what you just said. But freedom we have an insane type of freedom that's posited in our culture, which is the mm-hmm. freedom of the individual, which is like when you take it to the extreme, it's this unrestrained libertarian anarchist who's a kind of capitalist entrepreneur that can do anything they want to do because there ain't no laws, you know, except for the law of the market, the free market and such.
How about the freedom of the gay man and the lesbian, or the freedom of the woman to pursue a career, or the freedom of you to get a higher education?
Well, those are a whole cluster of things there. I've read that in, you know, just to get back to your original question, that in so-called native societies, they did have room for gay people and, you know, even people with physical handicaps and such. The other stuff that you talked about, the education, might not apply because, What does a school like this exist for? UConn, does it exist to make farmers out of us? You know, no. It exists to equip us for some type of industrial or post-industrial economy. So getting back to the definition of freedom, though, freedom, there's a definition, a communalist definition of freedom that would you might define as a kind of interdependency where people are allowed to develop their own unique thing, their own talents. And I think that you could find non-industrial cultures where that was happening. And
you think that in most tribal societies, people were more free to develop their own thing than in urban society?
Well, could you define freedom? Because I've tried to give you the individualistic one, you know, the sacred individual of our culture in a nutshell,
sure.
versus maybe what I consider, I saw a movie last night called Himalaya, you know, about these Tibetan Nepali folks who seem to be, like the word freedom might not even come up in their world, mm-hmm. but they were all part of a community where they were contributing and they felt full and whole and happy and healthy, you know? So what is freedom then?
Well, but I don't think you can conflate some kind of organic integration with a society, which may have a lot of advantages over our contemporary enemy and alienation, with freedom. I mean, for me, freedom is freedom from the material constraints and freedom to develop your abilities and your talents and your intellectual capabilities, freedom to associate with people, freedom to write and say whatever you want, freedom to sleep with whoever you want. All of those are freedoms which are more fully developed in industrial societies than in tribal societies. Now, it may be that we've also sacrificed along with that some integration with extended family, some integration with some connection to nature and its processes. But just the term freedom, it strikes me, is more fully developed here.
Well, there's a little transcendentalism there, because I'm not too sure that it's possible to disassociate ourselves from the material. And that one of the cultural malaises that we have is this belief that we can go beyond the material. Abbey, for instance, you know, just to throw him in, mm-hmm. called himself an earthiest, and he believed that there was no heaven or hell other than there was here on this earth during this life, and that, you know, so you might say he was following a Nietzschean line or a Blakean line mm-hmm. in that respect. But he was also working with a sophisticated theory of consciousness, you know, Heidegger's theory that naming, that the word creates cosmos, and wait, that language what? Is a sort of infection.
Wait, would that, you have called that, him a deep, that, a deep ecologist? Was he a deep ecologist?
Who?
Abbey.
Oh,
I mean, did he
no,
believe
he's
that?
He's definitely thrown in there. He would certainly have said, nah, you know, I'm just a writer, and I'm trying to make $1 million off of this pulp fiction. But he, when he gets anthologized, he gets thrown in the.
And how would you define deep ecology?
Deep ecology would be just an attempt to disengage from the so-called anthropocentric cosmology, you know, the mm-hmm. the man-centered cosmology. But you can't really do that. You can't, because, you know, the biocentric, you know, would be the other side, biocentric versus anthropocentric. A biocentric consciousness is still anthropocentric because it's still happening in our minds. Mm-hmm. It's more of an exercise of trying to take into account the shared field of being, that we are, to get back to water, we're connected to everything, that those little frogs need clean water as much as we do. And, you know, maybe we should save the frogs. Maybe we should save, because if we save the frogs, we'll save the water.
Is deep ecology just a matter of feeling connected, or isn't it a matter of placing equal value on animal and natural processes than you do on human life? In other words, if given a choice to kill 100 people or kill a forest, you might choose to kill the 100 people.
Well, that's a kooky predicament, because when has that ever happened?
Not so kooky to a lot of people.
When has that ever happened?
Well,
it happens the other way around.
It happens all the time.
It happens the other way around, where people with machine guns show up to people who are living in the forest and say, you better get out or else we'll kill you because we're going to cut these down.
Well,
I've never heard it happen.
The majority of all domestic terrorist acts since 9/11 in the United States have been committed by eco-activists inspired by deep ecology. So I don't think it's at all a kooky idea.
Well,
they've committed more than $5 million worth of terrorism.
They've redefined the definition of terrorist, haven't they, because of that Patriot Act, which...
Well,
nobody really read, and
burning
people
down,
are starting to worry about
burning down academic facilities, destroying intellectual research. It's, you know, they haven't killed very many people. They haven't taken machine guns to people. They haven't blown up buildings. But
all right. Well, I'm not going to defend that type of activity, but I do know that.
I'm just saying that
deep
ecology does lead to that conclusion.
That their line is this: that they don't attack people; they attack machines, which could. This was all about Ned Ludd, too, right?
Yeah, well,
discussion.
Well,
we're
exactly.
We're getting to Ned now.
Yeah. Some of our correspondence has been about the nature of the Luddites. By the way, this is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, and I'm speaking with Kurt Heidinger. He's an ecological activist here in Connecticut, and he's writing his dissertation on Edward Abbey. So, Kurt, you don't like my... my continued flogging of the Luddites.
No, actually,
the poor, disenfranchised 1820s.
No, it's not that I don't like it. I like it in the way a little kid likes a mosquito bite and just keeps on scratching it, and it gets itchier the more you scratch it. It's one of those deals. I'm fascinated by the way that, you know, the Luddite is now, you know, the communist of 1950, that it's a word of approbation, it's an epithet, it's almost a swear word. And so that, you know, I'm happy. I'm glad that people are afraid of Luddites. I've never met one yet. but I like tree huggers. And today I found out, you know, that the word truth actually derives from the word tree. Mm-hmm. Something to think about.
In your activism and environmental politics, you've never met anyone who said they would like to return to a pastoral society and get rid of industrial civilization.
Come on, that's Thomas Jefferson speaking there. That's an American pastime.
Okay. So, but you have met people like that.
Just like one out of three people in the United States today.
I agree.
Probably
I agree.
Dreaming.
There's a deep romantic Luddite strain.
Anytime I go to the supermarket and look for leafy greens that don't have pesticides on them, I think I'm partaking in that dream.
For me, the difference between that deep romanticism on the part of most Americans and an actual Luddite is that the Luddite is consistent. If you say to the average American, yeah, you think things might have been better in the good old days, but do you want to give up your computer, your penicillin, your car? They say no. And the Luddite says yes.
Well, because that dream of the pastoral landscape and of being, you know, Farmer Joe or Old MacDonald's farm comes right out of the natural law tradition. And whenever we go back to the founding era, we think of the yeoman farmer who Jefferson defined as a person who got natural virtue by being a farmer, that there was some type of mystical symbiosis between the farmer and the soil that would create a virtuous democratic citizen. And Little House on the Prairie was a version of that. So that, and every time we listen to country music, you know,
Kurt, do you think farmers are morally superior citizens to industrial workers or white-collar workers?
Wendell Berry seems to be.
He's someone who thinks they are. Yeah, exactly. There are people who think they are.
Scott Nearing, I thought, was pretty good. I don't think that there's a hardwired connection between virtue and agriculture. I think that virtue is a practice that anybody can begin or practice or employ themselves in, participate in. On the other hand, if you compare, maybe virtue is not the right word. Life or quality of life might be a phrase. If you compare the quality of life of a person who's not involved in an agro-industrial farm, but is
you mean like the majority of farmers in the third world,
and in our country too. You know, the Plutonic type of...
Wait, were you about to tell me that the majority of farmers in the third world agriculture have superior lifestyles to urban people?
Well, again, we have to start... Superior wasn't a word that I used.
Okay.
It was a quality of life. So it's not quantitative, like superior or less superior. It was a quality.
So they may be poor, and they may want to get out of it as quickly as possible and move to a city and even live in a slum if necessary, but they have a higher quality of life.
And so right there you've assumed that, like, the capitalist industrial system is what it's going to solve the problem.
I just assume most people don't want to live on a farm, and they get out of them as quickly as they possibly can.
Well, I guess you can assume that.
See, I come from the Marxist tradition. In the Marxist tradition, we see industrial progress as, in fact, progress. And what the goal is, yes, everybody should be able to have a garden if they want a garden. Everybody should be able to voluntarily go out and grow vegetables if they want to do that. But for people to have their lives be constrained and entrapped in necessary agricultural production as their only option in life, that's what we object to. And in fact, when people have other options in life, they tend to choose them, even if they're miserable options. Right? That's where I'm trying to go with this line of questioning.
That Jefferson's vision of the classic American would have been really an organic farmer that didn't use money. He bartered, in fact, his whole life. There was no currency on Monticello. He was not a perfect man, but he's one of the people that defined the vision of the United States. The person who lives... some of the virtues of that lifestyle were supposedly that you'd be self-sufficient and that you could raise a family, and also that you'd have a community.
Why is self-sufficiency a virtue?
Because the idea was that they were leaving Europe and the feudal monarchical.
I know the urban. Why they think. Do you think self-sufficiency is virtue? Because you said our interdependence with nature, recognize our interdependence with nature, is one of the great virtues of a person's life. Why isn't recognizing our interdependence with other human beings, or actually having interdependence with other human beings, a virtue as well?
I think it would be and. It's not either or there. Mm-hmm. That when you talk about a person being creative and doing something individually, they have to be self-sufficient to a certain extent. On the other hand, if they create something that nobody wants, if there is no interdependency, then they're an alienated nothing.
Human beings are not products de novo. We are all products of a human society, and recognizing that interdependence, I mean, this is, again, a Marxist insight, is that industrial civilization brings people together and forces them to recognize their interdependence.
Okay. Maybe, can we digress, since this is a wild racing discussion? The area that Marx studied in England was the area where the Luddites were, mm-hmm. right? Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
So he accepted the machines that they wouldn't accept, mm-hmm. okay?
Right.
The reasons that they destroyed the looms was that there were people from London coming in and setting up factories and saying, you must work here. You can no longer have the wool. You can no longer collect the wool together, distribute the wool. You can no longer have your feudal organic whatever system of government and economy here. Okay, those machines were in factories, and they were what these people saw, and what Byron wrote about was that they were being forced to work on those machines, and that they were losing the outdoors, and they were losing a very slow time frame, you know.
Well, they were losing their jobs too. I mean,
and that there was a whole constellation of community relationships that were being destroyed by the machines. All the capital that they were creating for these factory owners was going straight to London, so they weren't getting any money out of it to begin with. And they fought the machine right when it appeared. And then Marx came along, and what has happened is that the factory owners had perfected these techniques so well that these were now large-scale prison houses, basically, where people would gather out front and fight for jobs because they were all starving in the streets. And these great cities where Marx is writing or getting his insights about capitalism, Edward Abbey and Jefferson saw as prisons.
Right.
And so that's where that pastoral dream that's why it's the escape. That's why it's the answer. So that whenever mm-hmm. any American who's stuck at McDonald's, for instance, flipping hamburgers, which is a good job by world standards, no doubt, if they have a chance to daydream while they're flipping 60 hamburgers at the same time, they might think of, God, I'd love to jump in a lake right now, or why am I not sailing? Why am I not outdoors? Why am I stuck in this mega machine? Why am I a part of this machine? Mm-hmm. So I'm not a Marxist. I guess that's what I was getting to.
Yeah.
Because Marx, I think, took a democratic ethos and applied it to those systems without attacking the machines. He thought that he could separate the capital from the machine.
Absolutely.
But you can't.
Absolutely. He would have said that the solution to the problems of the Luddites was that they needed job retraining, they needed public assistance, they needed universal health care, but they didn't need to go and smash the machines, which were going to provide cheaper clothing for all of them, and potentially allow the creation of an 8-hour day as opposed to a 12-hour day, because they wouldn't need to work as long to make the same kinds of clothes. See, I want a society in which we can all work 4-hour days or 2-hour days, and I don't see us getting to that kind of society. We could go back to hunter-gatherers and then have 35-year lifespans, but I want a full, rich society with all the benefits of our science, technology, and progress, and a short working week. So I don't see us getting there unless we go through this industrial process. It needs to be democratized. We need to have environmental protection. But the deep ecological pastoralism seems like a total dead end to me.
Well, you might say that it's a historical relic at this point.
Yeah.
Because
Except that there seems to be a growing coherence of Luddite forces on the right and the left. And the stem cell, we only have a couple minutes, but the stem cell debate in Washington seems to be an example of this. And I just want to touch, I mean, obviously we have to have you come back, Kurt, and we'll flog this again. And Dr. Richard Sherman's still in the audience, and we could do actually a full hour on this with Richard. But just give you the example, stem cells.
Oops, sorry.
That's okay. Stem cells is this issue where Friends of the Earth and a bunch of other progressives, motivated by a kind of fundamental set of what I call Luddite concerns about human beings violating natural boundaries and natural law, et cetera, have gotten together with people on the right to stop what I consider a technology which is going to help cure Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's and all kinds of other wonderful things. And so I do think that it's not a dead issue. Luddism is alive, and it's affecting American public policy.
I think that it's a healthy, well, let's talk about the precautionary principle then. Why would there be resistance against this type of research? And there are some good reasons. One of the, why should there be a concern? Because it's the genie out of the bottle problem, that things could be developed and could be exposed to the environment that could affect a lot of other people and could even mess up the entire evolutionary continuum. On the other hand, you know, just to give you your side some credit, if the United States doesn't get with it, you can read that China's already got stem cell research going. So that even if the United States stops, there are some companies that with multinational reach that could be in China right now. I don't know the names of them. Pharmaceutical company, some chemical agro company. I don't know. Could be funding these studies, and we'll be able to patent them through the Chinese government instead of the United States government.
I believe in enforceable world law, so I wouldn't argue that it's good for China to be able to get away with something that we're not, but... But we do have to have you back. And just in response to the precautionary principle, I think there's a difference between having a precautionary principle that says wait a year and do good clinical research and wait 500 years and do good clinical research. And that's the nub of it. The idea of a precautionary principle is fine.
I don't think that you have to worry, because the fact is that the Chinese are doing it. And if they're doing it, there's some other countries that are up to this. In fact, they're doing it in Worcester, just 60 miles from here. So
right.
What I think... The Luddites, well, I'll just read one thing in parting.
Okay.
But in 1956, the President of the United States said, "The continuance of the present rate of hydrogen bomb testing by the most sober and responsible judgment does not imperil the health of humanity." All right, that was a national address, because people were wondering about those atom bombs blowing off.
Right.
Then March 1st of this year, just the headlines, almost all in the U.S. have been exposed to fallout study finds. So there's the paradigm that you've got the people in whose interest it is to say that everything's okay with the cloning, with the Gentech and everything, they're going to say it. And I think you're right, unless there are real studies done, and unless the companies are required to submit their data to federal agencies, which means bureaucracy, that
which I'm for.
Well, we're gonna have a lot of trouble, and it's too bad that we are getting cut off, because there's a lot to talk about in the canola world, where Monsanto is definitely spreading its wild.
Kurt, let's do a whole show on
its
canola.
Clone. All right. Long live Ned Ludd.
Yeah. I've been speaking with, this is Jay Hughes, Change Shipper Radio. I've been speaking with Kurt Heidinger. He's an ecological activist here in Connecticut, and he's an avid and engaged listener who we're going to have back to debate this whole field of Luddism and canola for the future. So thank you, Kurt.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.